Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I humbly accept your nomination to be the Democratic candidate for the governor of the great state of New Jersey. People all across New Jersey are demanding change, and I am here to change things. I believe so much in this state and everyone who makes this state their home. But today, I am less certain that the successes I have are available to this generation and those who will follow. And that, most of all, is why I'm running for governor, to change business as usual. It starts with fully funding public education, making college more affordable. It means an economy that is strong, competitive, innovative, and fair. We will establish a public bank owned by our citizens that puts New Jersey's money to work for New Jersey and not Wall Street. We are on this path together. Together, we can change New Jersey. Together we can.
Those hopeful, enthusiastic comments are excerpts from the acceptance speech of New Jersey Democrat gubernatorial candidate Phil Murphy, who won a resounding victory in his primary battle to lead his party to the state house that is currently occupied by Chris Christie. The remarkable part of that audio clip to us is, of course, that he's taken a bold and clear stand to create a state-owned public bank as part of his economic plan for recovery. You heard some of the economic and social issues and commitments that he's making, the context of his message, that the people's interests need to be represented for once versus the powerful Wall Street interests that have dominated state politics. And he's a former Wall Streeter. Hi, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute and co-host of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. On today's show, we're going to talk a bit about the meaning of Murphy's win for the public banking prospects, not just in New Jersey, but also around the country, and why we at the Public Banking Institute, while nonpartisan practitioners, are so hopeful that Murphy's political commitments will encourage other political candidates to incorporate public banking into their campaigns as well. Also on the show today, Ellen will be speaking with the person who Yanis Varoufakis worked with back in 2015, back when he was Minister of Finance for Greece, to develop a replacement monetary system using digital technologies to replace their dependence on the euro, the European Union, and their central banks, if they were successful to break away. You might remember that we talked a good bit about what that fiscal tragedy meant for all of us, as the democratic will of the people fell prey to the global financial cartel. Lionel Denenberg is Ellen's guest and will describe how the system that didn't get deployed in Greece is being deployed here in the States and offers a new prospect for helping to build a more resilient monetary structure for us as we look for viable alternatives that can mitigate the dangers of relying on the Federal Reserve. And we'll be visiting with Chuck Grigsby, the man who is helping to lead a legislative initiative in Massachusetts for a depository iBank, to help fill the needs for cities and towns that can't get the capital they need to do their infrastructure repairs. And this is happening in a state that rejected a previous effort for a public bank back in 2011. But now let's visit with Ellen, as there's a lot to talk about this week in the world of monetary news and developments.
All right, Ellen. Well, this has been a big week in the world of global finance and in public banking. We're celebrating a very, very big win for public banking with the electoral victory of gubernatorial candidate Phil Murphy in New Jersey, who has built his economic recovery program for the state on creating a state bank. This is an enormous shift for public banking, because it suddenly mainstreams what has been, in our circles, a theoretical discussion almost about how public banks could make a difference. Now we have a guy who's likely to become the next governor of New Jersey, who's actually on the trail and committed to creating a state bank, and in part, as you suggest, because he himself was a banker.
We found that the people who seem to get it and take it in their between their teeth and run with it are the people who have been bankers and understand how banking works. So Phil Murphy was a Goldman Sachs banker, and that actually was one of the criticisms of him, I guess, by his opponent. But he won the Democratic nomination, and therefore he's expected to win in the governorship. So that would be amazing if he funds his platform with public banking, as he has spoken, said numerous times that he plans to do.
In his victory speech, he again emphasized that one of the things he was going to do was to create the state bank to keep the money in New Jersey and not send it to Wall Street. So he was speaking directly against those who were accusing him of being a patron of Wall Street and really taking a stand for the people. A very popular sort of an attitude there. And of course, direct contrast to the Chris Christie administration that has been siphoning money off to Wall Street in a whole host of different ways. So we're excited to see how that does. And, of course, what we've also seen, Ellen, is that in states around the country, the biggest challenge that public banking has is at the state level because of the big bank influence in the political circles. So I think we all should hold our breath, cross our fingers, toes, and eyes to hope that Murphy is able to succeed with getting a public bank passed through the state legislature. There's certainly no guarantee that will happen, but I know that around the country and around New Jersey, they're gearing up to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. I wrote in the Public Bank Solution about the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which was actually this brilliant model that, unfortunately, we didn't follow. I mean, our Federal Reserve was basically private and serving the banks, but the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, set up in 1912, was run by a banker who understood how banking worked, but he also turned code on his fellow bankers and used the ability of a bank to create credit, to just create credit for the country, and basically rebuilt the country without having to borrow from the banks and without having to borrow from the Bank of England.
Speaking of England and populist politics, the Jeremy Corbyn uprising represents, I think, a significant step too, no?
Oh, amazing. An amazing upset. The reason Theresa May even called that election was she wanted to solidify her majority and, you know, just get rid of this, even whether there was any question about the Conservatives being in control. And in fact, the Labour picked up 26 seats. Of course, not quite enough to make him Prime Minister, but really significant challenge. The Conservatives lost their majority in Parliament. And the thing about Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, he's like more of a socialist than Bernie Sanders even. So it's the Bernie Sanders phenomenon in the UK, but he's actually making amazing strides. And among other things he proposes to do is to renationalize a number of things. He's going to renationalize were he prime minister, renationalize the railways, nationalize the water industry, and nationalize the mail service, which they privatized, and everybody agreed that was a big mistake. Make college tuition free, and reintroduce the 50% tax on people earning more than £123,000 a year, which is radical.
Yeah, well, and we read just today that there are now five people in the world that have more assets than the bottom 50% of the entire planet. This outrageous, really, this obscene inequity and deprivation is roaring across the horizon of the earth as private interests sweep in to take control of financial power. And of course, your article about the Fed funds rate is yet another example of how the large banking interests are consolidating and controlling debt and power.
Yeah, the fact that so few people can have so much money is a function of compound interest or the exponential growth of money making money. So it's totally a function of our financial scheme, which needs to be completely overhauled. I mean, we need a different banking system, and that's what I'm trying to finish up a book on that. So that's the whole gist of the book. And our interviewee today, it will be talking about how we can redo the system with a digital currency that would work. But anyway, so yeah, I wrote about that it was a mistake, that it was going to kill the recovery to raise interest rates yet again. The Fed is raising them for the third time since Donald Trump was elected president and is aiming to raise that, this is the Fed funds rate, the rate at which banks borrow from each other, to 3.5% by 2020. The problem is if they do that by 2028, according to, I think, the Office of Budget and Management, that will raise the interest that Congress will be paying on the federal debt to $830 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's almost $1 trillion every year in interest, which is $1 trillion is about what the government gets in income taxes. So virtually our entire income tax bill is going to be wiped out by interest on the federal debt, and there is absolutely no reason that we need to be paying interest at all. What the Federal Reserve should do, what they're proposing to do, is unwind all those securities that they bought, dump them back on the market, so we'll have to pay interest on them as well. What they should do instead is buy the entire federal debt, and the Japanese are actually doing that. They've bought 40% of the federal debt that Bank of Japan has, and it has. But the reason nobody does that is everybody thinks that's going to be inflationary. But in Japan, the inflation rate is 0.2%. That's not 2%, but 0.2%. They can't even get it above that. And here, their central bank owns 40% of the federal debt. Like our central bank rebates, returns the interest to the government after deducting its cost to Congress, I mean, or the Treasury. So basically, it's interest-free money for the central government, which can just keep rolling the loans over and over. So it's basically the same as issuing your own currency. It's like sovereign currency because you don't have to pay it back. And the way that the Federal Reserve raises rates is by paying interest on excess reserves. So we have $2.2 trillion in excess reserves sitting on the bank balance sheets, which they can't do anything with but lend to each other. So it really makes no sense to be paying them interest on excess reserves anyway. But
let me interrupt for a second, Ellen. Would you define, please, what excess reserves is for our listeners?
Okay, so there is a reserve requirement of around 10%, varies according to bank size, but so you're supposed to keep 10% of your deposits in reserve and you can lend up the rest. But because the Federal Reserve bought all these assets off the banks, in which they did through their reserve accounts, the reserve account is a totally different banking system from the one we use. Like, we don't get to trade with the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve keeps these reserves in order to clear checks. So if one bank issues a loan, which we now know they do just by writing the money into your checking account, they don't borrow it from anywhere, they just write it in there. But when the check goes into another bank, it has to clear. So they have to pull that money from somewhere, and they pull it from the reserve account and move. So it's just really an accounting function where they just keep track of where the money is. It moves from one bank to another. They still stay in the system, so it's still going to be $2.2 trillion in excess reserves, and we're paying $22 billion right now, and when the Fed raises rates, which they're expected to do today, we'll be paying $27 billion. And if they raise rates to 3.5%, as they're talking about, we'll be paying $77 billion to the banks for nothing, free money, for
right,
just having their excess reserves sit there, and they really have no choice about those excess reserves. Ben Bernanke has said we could do away with the reserve requirement, and you know, in England, I think it's 1%. I mean, reserves really serve no purpose except to clear checks. It's a total sleight of hand, you know, pretending to have money they don't have, give it back the next day, borrow it again that night, give it back the next day.
So we're all locked into this centralized system of money management or money financial obfuscation, the Federal Reserve System, privately owned and privately manipulated for the benefit of the banks. And if they crash or they do something stupid, which of course they do every 8 to 10 years, then we're all in trouble. Our guest today, your guest today, Lionel Denenberg, actually instituted a new digital currency kind of a platform. He demonstrates that with auxiliary or complementary currencies, we can sidestep that vulnerability with Fed misprision or malfeasance or deception, whatever we want to call the Fed Reserve System.
Yeah, well, or another way to look at it is that if you set up, what's exciting about what he's proposing is that, or he's actually done it, set it up for Greece, Yanis Varoufakis's plan, in the event that Greece were to leave the euro system, which they didn't do. But we in California could issue our own currency in the form of an alternative currency. And then if Wall Street goes down, which would make, because everything's so interlocked in the dollar system, it would make every other states and everybody else would go down with it, just as happened in 2008. But if you had an alternative currency that was like Calcoin or Cal dollars issued digitally, then you'd be protected against that. You have somewhere to go with your, you'd have probably some savings in that account in the first place, and then you have a way to trade. It's similar to what Argentina did when their currency collapsed, and then they had all these local currencies that weren't digital. They were printed on paper, which was one problem because they could be counterfeited, and that's one reason
And another variation on that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the Bank of North Dakota in 2008 also demonstrated the resilience and adaptability of local economies because they were rather isolated from the federal system. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, totally. That's what they did. That's what setting up their own bank was for them, was state sovereignty, keeping their money in the state to trade for their own purposes. The problem we would run with having states issue their own currency, even an alternative currency, is that constitutionally we're not supposed to be issuing money as a state. But there are actually 13 states now that have bills pending to issue a state currency. But these are state currencies backed by silver or gold because the Constitution does say that states can use silver or gold to pay their debts. But I think we can argue, I mean, you've got the states doing marijuana now, medical marijuana, which federally is not allowed. I mean, we have all sorts of rebellion against the federal system. And the reason we delegated our right to issue our own money as colonies to the federal government was because we delegated it to the federal government, but they didn't take it. They gave that power to the banks. So it seems to me we could legitimately take it back.
Yeah. And just finally, before we have to move on, this week in Massachusetts, there's a joint meeting about a new infrastructure bank bill that's being brought forward. Our guest, Chuck Grigsby, himself a banker, or as he calls himself, a recovering banker, who was the president of the Massachusetts Growth Capital Fund, is going to be making the case that the centralized banking system, or at least the big banks, the bond markets and so forth, that controls how much money states and cities can get for infrastructure, is no longer able to serve the needs because they put a cap on how much money the states can borrow or the cities can borrow. And so that the iBank that they propose would be able to fill in what is a gaping hole in finance. Again, working with the infrastructure needs that are so that everybody's so clear about, and I think that's a pretty exciting sort of development.
Yeah, and I thought his bill was brilliant. What's cool is that he understands the whole system, knows what language to put in there, knows what to cover, and the difference. Of course, California has an iBank, and so do a number of states. But they're not depository banks, but his bill makes it a depository bank that will take public monies, not private money, just like the Bank of North Dakota, where it's the government's money that's put into the Bank of North Dakota.
And as you'll hear from Chuck, he said the reason that he got it to the floor was to promise and to write into the bill a refusal to compete with the community banks and others, and now they have at least the buy-in to the idea. Well, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in the country around money and around banking and around public interest and public action. You know, the people are really fired up, really, around the world, I think, directly as a result of the failure of the systems that we're working with and that we live with to really meet the needs of what people need and how the systems have been co-opted and corrupted by private interests. That's a mouthful, Ellen, but I think you know what I'm saying. I know you do.
All right.
So I will just say thank you for this, and we'll see what happens next.
Okay, thank you. Great talking
Take
to you,
care.
As always.
We now head to Massachusetts, where the state legislature has begun a process of review of a bill to create a Massachusetts State Infrastructure Bank, which states that the bank will be a financial institution able to accept deposits from public and quasi-public entities, float bond issues, and chartered as such by the Commonwealth. And the subject of infrastructure finance is high in the news, as promises to invest over $1 trillion by the new Trump administration have dwindled to a nominal $200 billion, with inside reports indicating that there is, in fact, no new money being allocated for states and municipalities in the new Trump budget. Now, this leaves local and state executives in a very tough spot. Where do we get the money to fix stuff if we have to borrow it? And if the banks won't give us any more money, what are we going to do? Well, our guest, Charles Grigsby, a recovering banker, as he calls himself, and the founder and former president of the Massachusetts Growth Capital Fund, has taken the bull by the horns and is helping to drive a new solution in the state with the help of our colleagues in Boston, the Hub Public Banking Team. Public banks categorically address and offer real-world solutions for infrastructure finance. But Massachusetts doesn't have one, and therefore can't avail itself of those solutions. In fact, in 2011, this same legislature voted down the idea of a state bank, largely due to big bank influence and claims that there was plenty of money to lend from existing bank markets. Chuck Grigsby was on that commission in 2011 that voted down the state public bank idea. He was one of three votes that supported the idea. But he's now taken up the cause by taking the lead in addressing the specific failings of the current financing system and how it impacts local economies and local governments. In the history of public banks' emergence in the United States, the experiences of citizens being shuttled aside when they bring solid opportunities forward for legislative approval is consistent. Big bank influence at the highest levels of state government have sabotaged those efforts. We saw that in Vermont, California, Maine, Maryland, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, just to name a few. Chuck Grigsby remembers how that played out in Massachusetts back in 2011.
That was a commission formed by the legislature. Senator Spilka formed it, and they larded it with bankers. And so the commercial bankers, both large banks, the national banks and small community banks, were absolutely fearful that an infrastructure bank would compete with them, and so they killed it. They said it was not needed, that the state agency did this, that there was no reason to do this, and we're so much superior to North Dakota, we don't need this, and so they killed it. I was probably one of three votes against the decision, but the community bankers essentially killed it by saying this is going to compete with us and so we don't want to see it. So that was my first stop when I started this effort. I went to see president of the Mass Bank Association, Kevin Kiley, and said, Kevin, we will not compete with you. We'll put that in the statute, that this will not compete with community banks unless community banks ask us to participate. Then we'll join you. So he said, fine. With that, I'll also support it. They may not be pushing behind it, but they should not oppose it now, because the language says we will not compete with community banks. We will have no ATMs, no branches. We will not take private and commercial deposits. We will not initiate loans unless we're asked to by a community bank in participations. So we will not compete with community banks in lending.
The bill says that it will take deposits from public and quasi-public agencies.
Right.
So, and that's not the bread and butter of commercial banks.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So, Chuck, you've done some research examination with among municipalities in the state of Massachusetts, and what did you discover was a common thread of need and interest?
I asked Barry Bluestone at Northeastern University, who's an economist, to join me in signing a survey, which we did to 37, maybe almost probably almost 40 mayors across the state, all the way from the Berkshires to the Cape and the Islands. And we were simply, we were trying not to scare them, but we were saying, asking them, what is your experience with getting, with arranging infrastructure financing? So of the 37 questionnaires we got about a 65% return rate, which is pretty good. And 38% of those respondents said they are having trouble raising financing. And those are the ones that admitted it. I think there are others that I recognize looking at their consolidated annual financial reports, and I know they're having a problem, but they didn't want to admit it even in a survey. So I said, okay, 38% have said they've had trouble raising financing, but then 55% said they've had to defer even priority projects because of financing. 55% was the, I think, a pretty high number of municipalities say that they have to defer projects. One of the towns was the town of Andover, a rich little community on the North Shore. I'm surprised to see them say that, but they even had to defer projects.
Why is that?
Because of the cap, the artificial cap of 6% of your operating budget for debt service. If you have debt service over 6% of your operating budget, the bond market doesn't want to deal with you. And so they kind of squash that artificial ceiling on towns which could go much higher. Massachusetts Internal Revenue says most towns would be okay with 10 to 14% of their budget debt service, but you wouldn't want to go that high, but that means that they're giving up a lot of cash that they can't use because the bond market says you can't use it. And when you see a town would look at their consolidated financial returns, and they creep up to 6%, and then they stop borrowing. They can't borrow anymore after that until they pay down a lot of their debt.
Wow.
So it's an artificial cap that keeps bonds secure and bonds safe, but doesn't help the towns, cities, and towns. So I was curious, how long ago was it that we've had seen defaults in Massachusetts in municipal bonds? And the short answer is, according to Moody's, the last default was the Boston Regional Medical Center in 1999, 18 years ago. Before that, it was 1990, the Choate Sims Hospital, 27 years ago. So we have not had municipal bond failures in the state, in part because of, I think, the bond market has kind of capped the debt service ratio of cities and towns and doesn't let them borrow more than that.
Meanwhile, all of the infrastructure deteriorates for lack of attention.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
So the term infrastructure includes a lot of things, and the Massachusetts bill on the floor includes capital projects that serve the general public, like schools and public services.
Schools, yep.
Fire, police, health, public buildings,
right.
Water facilities, waste management.
Exactly.
I'm reading from the bill, or farmland preservation, public
right.
land management, climate
right.
change mitigation
right.
and adaptation, local
right.
roadways, bike paths, pedestrian walkways, etc., and more that's defined by the Board of Directors. So, I mean, that's quite
right.
a menu of need as well as quite a horizon of service.
Those are the things that cities and towns say they have trouble getting financing for. And you try to explain to the bond market that you want to do some waterway improvement, they say, well, gee, how's that going to increase revenue in the town? Well, it isn't. So it's going to make our town safer. It's hard to get financing for it. The MassWorks, which is the state program of making grant making, is mostly for roadway repair. They give last year they gave out $83 million, which was little less than 30% of the total request they got, which is typical, but that's mostly for roadway repairs. They would not give grants for waterway improvements or things that would improve water table
yeah.
safety of your town.
So you're familiar with the bond market rates. What kind of rates are the bond market getting from municipalities?
I looked at about 30 bond rates, and they went anywhere from 2% to 4%. An anomaly, though, is Boston, which has a AAA rating, is paying 5%, and I can't figure out why, and I don't know why. And I'm not sure the mayor knows that yet, but I was going to raise it when I see him. I was going to raise it with him. But Boston's paying 5%, but most towns are paying 3% to 4%.
What kind of a term are those notes?
They're often 3 to 5, and the longest would be 20 years, but most of them are within under 10 years.
Yeah. What kind of category of infrastructure would have a 20-year term?
I think that most school buildings would have long terms, even though they have state subsidy with participation in bond financing. But most buildings could have long terms because of the life of the building and the depreciation of a building. Roadway would have a shorter term, and so would a waterway or a culvert or a small bridge. But large buildings, big police stations or schools or buildings, public buildings would have longer terms, I believe, generally.
And of course, the offer from North Dakota's public bank for infrastructure to municipalities is 2% for 30 years. Would you just explain for our listeners why most banks would not offer 2% for 30 years and why you think that a public bank could?
Right. We're proposing that this public bank be capitalized by either a direct appropriation from the legislature, $50 million from the direct appropriation, or by an investment by our pension fund. Mass Pension Fund has total assets of $163 billion.
Wow.
So we're saying $50 million is just a drop in the bucket. And we could pay them, we think, a 5% dividend after we become profitable. So either way, there's a way to capitalize this bank from either direct appropriation or from an investment by the pension fund. By having the state deposit a minimum of 20% of its total deposits in the bank could lend money without charging more than 2%. It could easily lend money because its cost of capital would be low, and maybe 5% after taxes to a dividend if it's capitalized by the pension fund, or zero if it's capitalized by an investment by direct appropriation from the legislature.
Well, I know that you have a hearing coming up this week in the legislature on this bill. So you have revived and created a whole new agenda and momentum around a good idea that was buried years ago with the help of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston.
Right. Right.
Who said, oh, no, we don't need any more banks here. Congratulations on that. And I'm delighted to announce and thank you for giving us the time to come to the national conference in September.
I really look forward to that. That'd be great. Look forward to that.
Yeah.
The way I look at this, Walt, is this is a fresh shot. It may take two or three rounds of the legislature to get this through. I wouldn't be surprised at all if the legislature doesn't have the, I want to use the word courage, but that's what I think of, courage to do a progressive step like this the first time around. So it may take two or three rounds to get this through the legislature, but we'll keep at it.
That's Charles Grigsby, the former president of the Massachusetts Growth Capital Fund and a member of the Boston Hub Public Banking Group.
I'm speaking today with Lionel Denenberg, the Chief Technical Officer of Pay Services, Inc., who has designed a very interesting platform similar to blockchain. I don't know that it actually is a blockchain platform. But anyway, it's great to be talking to you, Lionel.
Hi.
We've only just met by phone, so
great.
We're feeling our way here. So can you say a little bit about what you're doing? What really piqued my interest was that you designed the currency that Yanis Varoufakis talked about, that I actually wrote about, that mm-hmm. they would have used as an alternative currency if Greece had left the European Union, but since they didn't, they're still on the euro. But it was an alternative drachma system, and you set that up, correct? So can you explain
yes.
a little bit about what you did there?
So basically, part of what we develop and the platform we develop, we are about not only to handle transactions in fiat currencies like US dollars or euros or British pounds, but also in cryptocurrencies like bitcoins, Ethereum, etc. And we're also able to create complementary currencies, which are currencies that are handled entirely on the system, not on blockchain, and with which we have actually a lot of full traceability and control over what's happening with the currency. And one of the things we actually, in 2015, we were working on for Greece, because Greece was about to leave the European Union. At the end, it didn't happen. We actually created a central reserve. It was called the Euro Drachma, the currency we had created. And it was we had actually a Euro Drachma central reserve account on Pay Services to handle that currency, which was basically the master account. And the idea was that Greece leaves the euro overnight. We could replace all the euros in Greece with a new type of currency that was entirely digital called the Euro Drachma, and that people could have access to and do all their banking needs through a mobile app that we have on the App Store. That was in the big lines what it was about.
So you were actually authorized to, in other words, the government would be issuing, I saw, was it 5 billion euro drachma and 3 billion for consumers so they could get 250 euros credit each?
The idea over there was that we had created 5 million euro drachma that were basically money that was issued initially, and the idea was to use those 5 billion and for the private sector, and another 5 billion euro drachma for the companies, and another 5 billion that would be for the government itself, its own budget to start to work with. And the way we designed the system was that the moment you are a person that's a resident of Greece, the moment you were approved was that automatically, if you're private, you receive 250 euro drachmas. And and if you were a business, you were getting a verified account, you were getting 2,000 to get verified and get started. And the idea was that this was a system to actually start to issue the currency and start to give it to people so that people could start to have it in their hands to actually start doing transactions. That was to answer your question, what it was about.
Oh, that's great. And was some of that for the government to spend, did you say?
Yeah, so the idea was to create in total for Greece, we had basically calculated what's the size of the market over there and about the population and how much money they had or didn't have in the banks. And there were actually two components. One component, the first one was actually before we even issued those newer drachmas, was to take whatever people have on account and replace it with your drachma. So if before the bankruptcy you had, I don't know, like 2,000 euros, you would receive automatically 2,000 euro drachmas on your account. We would have converted them for 1 euro for
oh,
1 euro drachma.
Right, right.
That's how we were replacing your money so that you wouldn't lose because, you know, let's say you worked, you had all your salary that was, I don't know, you had 25,000 euros, you don't want to use and start lose them and start again from zero. So the idea was to convert those euros that were lost into euro drachma that in Greece would have had value. Of course, they would have a huge deflation that would have occurred immediately for that new currency euro drachma. But at least in Greece, within Greece, it would have still kept its own value because that would have become the new currency of Greece. So that was the first component. And the second component, the moment you would be get verified, we would give you some new euro drachmas just as a gift to actually join the system. Because today, you know, when you open a bank account, automatically the bank asks you to pay fees, you know, to keep the account open and whatever you want to do. And so today, with the way the system works, is that you're born and you still didn't start to breathe that you already have a debt on your head. And so by giving you actually away some of your drachmas to people, by rewarding them to join the system, we're actually inverting the way kind of work by actually rewarding them for joining the system and not penalizing them for joining it, which is what happens today. Today, the more you get active into the economy, the more you're penalized. And the idea was there to boost the economy, to do it the other way around.
Yeah, that's great. So let's say theoretically, if we have another banking crisis and our big banks collapse, it seems that, I mean, I've just written this in a book I'm trying to get out. It seems that you could have the central bank just issue digital currencies to replace all those lost deposits, right? I mean,
yes.
That would be the same idea. Yeah.
That would be the same idea, and not only at a national level, but also at a state level. If a state would want to issue its own currency, we can create for them a state currency and a central reserve master account on the system. And it will be entirely a digital currency. It's not paper format or coins. It's entirely through a mobile app. We could, of course, issue them cards with some people, although it's not really useful because it's entirely through the mobile app.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I
yes.
understand that you already have security clearance or authorized, I guess, to set up a bank in Florida, which could then extend to California, for example. So if any state were ready to set up its own bank and actually issue its own currency even, you have the software ready to go, not just that it's designed, but it's actually got the government approvals that are necessary.
So for what happened with our platform is that there are two components. The first one is all about the security of the system and how we keep, you know, people's data, people's information, like socials, what they have on accounts, etc. That's the security of the IT of the platform. For that, we have our own PCI level 1 compliance. It's the highest you can get in the financial industry today for security of a system. And the second component is when you want to handle actually real money transactions and actually take care of the settlement of the money, which is what we're talking about here, is to get the license from a state. Now, a lot of across the country, a lot of currency exchanger for Bitcoin, they're registered actually with FinCEN. And they claim that this is enough for them to operate, which is true, but not entirely, because FinCEN doesn't really check very in detail from the first day before that you actually go online what you're actually doing.
Kind of missed that word. Can you say it? Are you saying FinTech?
FinCEN is the Financial Crime Enforcement Network. So
Of
people actually register with them as a money service business. Now, what we have here with Pay Services is that we have a money services business from the state of Florida. We had to be compliant with both at the state level and the federal level. And also actually part of them that are international, if they are foreigners that come on the platform and want actually to transact with us. And so what happens is that, for example, in the state of Florida, where we obtained the license, it took us about, let's say, almost a year, actually, 9-10 months to get it from the moment we actually put the application in there. And they actually did a really good work checking everything, how we approved the accounts, how things are actually working. And today we have the license, and basically we're authorized to do conventional things, but also more modern, innovative stuff with the new types of currencies, some called blockchains, some other called virtual currencies, other called them complementary currencies. There are all types of currencies out there and payment instruments, and we allow basically to do transactions in those payment instruments. And to close that chapter, the way we got around to be actually compliant with all the laws, because you know when you talk about cryptocurrencies, just on Pay Services there are close to 300 of them that you can trade with. So the way we did it is that if we have to report something to the authorities, like we are required by the law, if we do a transaction US dollar, we basically take every currency that's out there in the system and give it an exchange value in US dollars. And so that for the state, when we do our reporting, if we have to do a reporting, if there are some transactions that fall under the law that needs to be reported, for to the state, they are reported as United States dollar transactions, which is something that everybody understands and that is compliant with all the laws. Because at the end of the day, the state doesn't really care if it was made in Bitcoin, you know, or Ethereum or whatever coin you're going to call it, as long as it's compliant with the laws and we follow the same procedure and it's a language that they can understand.
You don't actually have Bitcoin or any of these community or alternative currencies, but that you're a platform where they can trade. So if somebody wants to sell and somebody wants to buy, they can use your platform.
Absolutely. So we can do actually two things on Pay Services. You can open a wallet and you can store your Bitcoins on Pay Services. Totally fine. It's really up to you. And you can have them on your computer, wherever you want. For us, it doesn't really matter, because we don't make any money by just keeping your value, to say it like that way, on our account. But if you want to do it, it's an option, it's available. Now, your question is more basically how we actually convert the money and do the exchange. Now, we Pay Services, we don't handle ourselves the exchange like banks do today. Like today, if you go to your bank and you want to fly to Europe, you would need euros. So your bank is doing the exchange for you. So it means that the bank is taking the exchange risk. The exchange rate that they give you is actually a good exchange rate for them or for you. We on Pay Services, because there are so many transactions, so many currencies out there, we can do it that for some a limited amount of currencies and transactions that we actually able to follow up on. But the big part of the currency exchange platform that we have out there is that it's people who actually come online and say, hey, I have 10 Bitcoins. I'm looking for $20,000 for those 10 Bitcoins. Make me offers. And people can tell you, hey, I'm willing to pay that price, so I'm bidding something else. I'm actually giving you $18,000. Or you can come tomorrow and say, I'm actually giving you $21,000 for it. And so people basically do the discussion directly one with another, and we then Pay Services only act as a secure pipe to put in contact both the buyer and the seller and allow them to do that transaction securely and by at the same time by being compliant with the laws of the country, of the land.
Mm-hmm. Which opens up the question of cannabis dollars, which is a big issue for a lot of states where technically they're federally illegal. So your system offers a secure way to, would you say, bank cannabis dollars or trade, or what can you do with those?
So the problem today is that when you want to buy cannabis, there are states like the state of Colorado, which is already legal, but it's legal within the state. The problem is that the U.S. dollar, which is handled by the Federal Reserve Bank, is the currency of the land. Although it's not directly controlled by the federal government, it's the currency of the land. And because it's the currency of the land, the Federal Reserve Bank is basically saying you cannot use our currency, because it's not the currency of the people, it's the currency of the Federal Reserve Bank. It's theirs that we are using. And they say you cannot use that currency to actually purchase cannabis. And so that's how basically they blocked people who want to do transactions and banks who wanted to serve those people from using it. That's why today most dispensaries you go to, you cannot actually use your credit card, because your credit card immediately, it's an electronic transaction. It can be used nationally and automatically using the currency of the land that can be used at anywhere, even in places where it's illegal. So they say you cannot use that. So we get into a situation where today the state says, yeah, it's legal within our land because you are within our boundaries, but you cannot use the payment instrument because the payment instrument is not controlled within the state or the state itself. Now, what we have on Pay Services that our technology allows to do today is that we can create, for example, a Colorado state dollar or a California state dollar, a currency, and having basically a California state dollar central reserve account, which is basically a master account, the same way the central reserve account is the Federal Reserve Bank is handling master accounts for all the banks across the country. But that account would be an account managed by the state for that state currency, and that would be the master account they would use across the state. Now, why it's very interesting is that with that currency, not only we can give back some sovereignty to the state to actually conduct their own policies and tax policies and economic policies within the state, but the very important aspect here is that we can, through the technology piece that we have here with the mobile app, we can limit its use within the physical land limits of the state, which means that, for example, if you would have tomorrow the California state dollar running on Pay Services and you are in California, you could use it because you are physically in California and California is managing what's happening in your own land. The moment you would cross the border to go to the state next to it, it wouldn't work because you're outside of the boundaries of the state where that currency is valid and permitted by the law, and you are now in a state where it's not permitted. Which means that basically we are here talking about recreating overnight the entire banking industry system that's out there with a new type of currency that will work within the state where it's actually legal. And all the technology I'm talking about you here is already it's already working, it's already available out there. Now it's just a matter for the state to actually say, hey, we want to go forward with this thing. The moment the state say, hey, it's okay for them, tomorrow morning we can have the entire state board and open the account and start to play with the state dollars.
Wow, that's great. I mean, that's what we're trying to do with the Public Banking Institute. Of course, there's a constitutional prohibition against states issuing their own bills of credit, as the Constitution puts it, which is taken to mean issuing paper dollar bills or coins. But the Constitution also says that states can only use silver and gold, which, of course, they don't use at all. But anyway, this has always been interpreted to mean that the states can't issue their own currency. But it seems to me, arguably, first of all, the reason the states or the colonies gave up that right was because they gave it to the federal government. But the federal government didn't exercise it. They basically delegated it to the banks. So the banks are actually issuing our credit or our money. And so a state that had its own bank would be issuing money in the form of credit, bank credit, the way all banks do. But then you still have the problem of conforming with all the banking laws, which means you have to get that money paid back. And the idea for a state would be able to issue a sovereign currency where they can actually pay for things, and it's not actually a debt, but actually a debt-free currency in its own right, which would, in order to avoid inflation, the way the American colonists did it, is you pull it back in the form of taxes. So you issue it first, spend it for whatever you need it for, infrastructure. And then that all generates taxes, which reduces the money supply again, so then you can issue it all over again.
I'm not actually too concerned about that because, you know, the simple fact that you've got states like the state of Colorado that legalize cannabis while the federal law says it's not, and you have people out there already doing transactions with that in cash today, really shows that the states themselves don't really give too much importance about what the federal is saying on several topics, and they kind of decide on their own what they want to do. Which means that at the end of the day, if the state tomorrow wants to issue its own currency, they actually have the power to do it. It's not really into the hands of the federal government to decide for them. And the simple fact that cannabis is the sale of cannabis is already legalized in some states is just an example of what I just said. Now, one big misconception a lot of people have about the Federal Reserve Bank, they think because it's called Federal Reserve Bank, it's actually the government, the federal government. But at the end of the day, there are only three things we know for sure about the Federal Reserve Bank. It's not a federal institution, it's not a reserve, and it's not a bank. It's just some institution that issue the currency, we could say, as they will. Although there are some laws out there to how it's done, but that's mostly the way it's done. And as you pointed out, a state gave up the right to issue their own currency if the federal government would do it, but in reality, that's not really what's happening. So if tomorrow the state would want to issue their currency, it's possible. It's out there, and the technology, and it's really, it's not a matter of technology today. It's not a matter of time, because tomorrow morning we could be online with the state currency. And I want to say something that some people might actually misunderstand. It's not because the state might actually issue its own currency that we would get rid from the U.S. dollar. The actual fact that we have or might have several currencies out there, it's actually a good thing. It increases the welfare of the state and only it helps improve the economy. Because if you actually buy something into the currency of the state, that wealth doesn't leave the state. It stays within the state. And it also serves as a backbone, as a backup, in case a crash happens with the U.S. dollar. Because, you know, if, for example, now there is a huge recession and the U.S. dollar crashes, I don't know, because whatever state, I'm just taking a state like Michigan. I don't have anything specific to say about Michigan, but just as an example, let's say tomorrow the state of Michigan crashes for whatever reason and creates a huge recession and it extremely devalues the U.S. dollar. Let's say now tomorrow that California has its own, doesn't have yet its own currency. Immediately they are impacted and affected. Although in California nothing changed, it's business as usual, but they are impacted because of Michigan. Now, if you consider the case where California would actually have their own state dollar and there is a crash with the United States dollar, it wouldn't directly impact them because people would still be able to transact state dollars in California, and the state dollar would still keep its own the same value that it had the day before the crash. So it also helps people to actually recover. And I always like the example, a very good example that people can picture very well. If you imagine an industrial forest where they actually grow trees for sale for woods, and you have, they only grow one sort of tree. So you might have 10,000 trees out there on that piece of land where they grow those trees that they cut every, I don't know, 3-4 years and that they sell. The problem with that one sort of tree, the system is extremely efficient because you only do one type of tree. But the problem is that if one of the trees is sick, automatically all the trees out there, the other 9,999 trees out there will get sick because they're all the same. So the virus propagates immediately. Now, if you imagine the picture of a jungle where you have hundreds of sorts of trees and plants, if one of them is sick, the jungle, the cycle of life continues because there are so many out there that are different. It doesn't impact everybody. So it actually, if let's say we are in a jungle and one type of plant is sick, the jungle continues and the welfare of the jungle will continue because only actually a small portion of it is actually sick. And that's how we have to see the world economy, is that the more there are currencies and we use the same currency, it can be very efficient, but it's actually a very big risk because the moment there's a problem, everybody is affected. And to take back the example of Europe that decided to create the euro and put it out there, one of the big problems of the Euros is that all the states, the countries within the European Union, first of all, they don't speak the same language, but they don't have the same culture towards money and value as well. And they don't have the same economy, type of economy at all. You don't handle a German company the same way you handle a company in Greece. It's not the same mentality. It's not the same way to do things. And that's why today you have those problems within the European Union, where you've got countries that are bankrupt. And if you take that to America, because America is a much older country, they kind of, all across America, is kind of the same mentality towards money. But still, you see that there are states that are bankrupt, and they will most probably never be able to recover from that. Why? Because the money, the type of value that they use, they have no control on it, so they are not able to conduct their own economic policies that will benefit their geographical area of land. And when you have an economic policy that's controlled at the federal level and you have a problem in a specific part of the country, it doesn't benefit them and they can't do anything about it. But if tomorrow the state has its own currency, then on top, so in addition to the federal policy about economics, they can give people some incentives at a local level because they are here locally and they have a value exchange that has a value locally and that people can understand and they can actually help them. So having different types of currency out there doesn't make us weaker, it makes us stronger and actually increases our wealth.
Yeah, that's great. My daughter would love that. She's her thing is biomimicry, where you set up systems that imitate nature. So that's a great image. I've been speaking with Lionel Denenberg, the Chief Technical Officer, Pay Services, Inc.
We'll be featuring more from that interview between Ellen and Lionel Denenberg in future It's Our Money programs. Finally, a closing word about the Phil Murphy electoral win in New Jersey. When we heard that Murphy had adopted a public banking platform for his campaign for office, that a mainstream party candidate, with a Wall Street background no less, was going to build his economic recovery plans on creating a state bank, we were almost out of our skins with excitement. We had crossed a threshold of political acceptability. Public banking had gone mainstream, or at least was headed there. During his campaign, Murphy never wavered from his clear support for the idea, and it caught fire in the state from civic groups, unions, and frustrated municipal managers who have been dealing with credit deprivation that confounded their attempts to make progress for their communities, all the way to the media. Murphy spoke to the heart of these complaints, that people want to have their money work for themselves, not private interests. The coming few months will test the public's commitment to this idea as we carry the message forward that banking in the public interest is an idea whose time has come. Perhaps we now have a winning champion for this cause, but it will be the people who carry this initiative forward in the face of cynicism and organized special interests, that there is definitely a fight ahead. But make no mistake, if Phil Murphy is true to his word and the people are up to the challenge, New Jersey may well break the ice that lets the public interest take a powerful stand against the private capital interests that have exploited them for so long. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!